The session is entitled Dependent or Free, and I have intended to share a Christian perspective on not just chemical dependency, but this whole tension or whole issue between being dependent on chemicals or people or things, God, versus freedom, and use some passages from the Bible to illustrate some of my thinking. And hopefully we'll get into this near the end of our hour. But I think we'll start out by talking a little bit about prevention of chemical dependency, since this was a concern that some people raised yesterday and we didn't have a chance to get into it. I've been working in the field for some years now, and two things strike me. One is that chemical abuse seems to be increasing. And the second factor is that we seem to have lost our ability to solve the problem. We talk a lot about what are solutions, how can you prevent it? And there are a lot of theories out there, but we don't seem to be preventing it very well. The increase and the rise of chemical dependency and chemical abuse of many different types of substances seems to be rising. And I wonder why that is. Maybe later some of you may have some thoughts on that. In our country, we're very good at fixing problems once they've occurred. But we aren't so good at solving the problems in the first place. We've developed a very sophisticated, well-oiled medical establishment to fix people up once they're sick. Kids run away, we have a lot of facilities for runaway children. If people have mental problems, we have a lot of excellent institutions for mental illness. And right on down the line, that once the problem is there, we have a very excellent way of dealing with the problem once it's already occurred. And the same with chemical dependency. We have tremendous treatment facilities where we can try to pick up the pieces and make the person whole and send them back out into life. In fact, in this country, we spend $200 billion each year on health care. $200 billion. And 98% of that figure is on treatment, fixing people up after they're sick or ill. 98%. 2% is spent on prevention. And so we don't seem to, we've lost our ability to solve problems as a person, or as a family, or as a community, or some would say even as a nation. And I certainly sense this and see this in chemical dependency. How do you prevent chemical dependency? And I'm putting it within this more broad perspective because it isn't just chemical dependency that we can't come up with solutions. It's in many other areas of our life too. It's sort of a general pervasive feeling or attitude that seems to have grown up in our society now. Some of you may disagree with that. We may want to talk about it later. There's a story of a group of people living in a town. It was on a river, and one day they noticed a lot of bodies floating down the river. And so the men of the village went out into the river and pulled them out, revived them, brought them to the hospital. The next day they looked out and here were some more bodies floating down the river. The next day, this continued month after month until the men of the village weren't doing anything other than pulling bodies out of the river. And they were becoming very tired and worn out from this. And finally one guy said, "The rest of you stay here and pull out the bodies, do what you can do. I'm going upstream and see who's throwing them in." And that's a little bit like prevention. That we have to, we got 98% of our time and energy and resources pulling the bodies out and fixing them up. And we only got 2% looking at who's up there throwing the bodies in the first place. Do you all get the concept, what's happening in the society? Okay, we're a society that uses chemicals. I think that's a given. Our children see them in ads daily. Last night I showed you some of the ads that are in every magazine on liquor, and they're very, very well done. these ad campaigns, they spend billions of dollars finding out what's going to appeal to us, how they can get us to try their product, and how we can get kind of hooked and dependent on it. And, you know, there are 20, 30 different beers out there we can all enjoy, and same number of cigarettes. And so it's a real thriving business. And this comes to the first point I want to make, that we have to have an awareness as individuals and as families that in our society there are a lot of forces trying to make us dependent on their products. And you have to realize that some of the products out there are not very good for us. And so if we're to counterbalance this, if we're to start looking at prevention, we have to have a general awareness of the enemy, of the Goliath, in a sense, and counteract it some ways. I've noticed now we have two children, a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old, and they like to watch Sunday morning or Saturday morning cartoons. Any of you have children that watch, you know, cartoons? Some of the ads now are not just always for the sugar-coated cereals, but they're putting in some nutrition ads about maybe having fruit. Have you noticed that? That's because a lot of people, and we'll get down to policy, a lot of people have complained that that's a lot of garbage that they're showing the children every morning through the ads. And so very slowly, TV, which is a powerful medium, is starting to take some responsibility for what they're saying to our children. And you have to be aware of what they're saying to you. I use the example of between 5:30 and 6:30 when the news is on. Many people have had a hard day at work and we're home relaxing, and maybe there's a headache or whatever, and a lot of the ads are from pharmaceutical companies telling us to take this product to make us feel better. Okay, so general awareness of the society we live in and the amount of money that's spent trying to get us hooked on certain products. And of course, once we're hooked, that's great, because we're going to keep buying the product over and over again, and we become dependent on that product. Okay, a second thought concerning prevention is skill building. There are two sorts of skills. We all have maintenance skills, skills that we can use to kind of maintain a healthy lifestyle. I brought along a visual aid here. You all know what this is, dental floss. And occasionally, once a week or whenever, we're supposed to use it on our teeth to maintain healthy gums, right? We all have certain skills in relating to people, relating to life, that kind of maintain our healthy functioning. And if we're going to prevent chemical dependency, we have to make sure that our skills in coping with life are going strong. Because a lot of people that turn to drugs, the reason they do that is that they've lost their ability to maintain proper, healthy, normal relationships, and also lost their ability to cope with stresses and problems that occur in all our lives. And so if there's an accident or a death or a firing or whatever traumatic might come into a person's life, they aren't able to cope, except by turning to a mood-altering chemical. And that helps take away some of the pain and the hurt. And they find that, hey, this really does help, it feels good, and a relationship is established, like we talked about last night and earlier in the week. A love relationship gets established with the mood-altering chemical. By the way, as I'm going through here, if you want to comment, you have observations, you want to illustrate with something from your own history, just break in. I kind of like to have a give and take. Third one, responsible use. Responsible use in terms of whether it's alcohol or sugar, or I'm also thinking here responsible use of your bodies. I mentioned last week we've been created with a 70-year warranty, and the human body, unlike a machine, improves with use. A machine, the more you use it, the quicker it's going to wear out. The body is just the opposite. If you don't use it, it wears out. and we either blow out or burn out or rust out, depending upon how we use our bodies. Some of us have to go in for repairs before our 7-year warranty's up. Others of us take care of our machine, our body, and we go on living a healthy, happy life way on past 70. And so responsible use of our body, what we put into it, how we fuel our body, what we're eating. A lot of us abuse our bodies by giving it too much sugar or not the proper fuel. It's a fact, I think, we take better care of our cars quite often than we do of our bodies. Okay, and also responsible use of chemicals, mood-altering chemicals. On Tuesday, I went through definitions, and I think because we're a society that uses chemicals, I'm not saying abstinence, because I think it's unrealistic, and as I mentioned last night, the problem is not the chemical, the problem is the person that's abusing it. And so if you are using chemicals, use them in a responsible manner.
I don't know if you've covered this in other sessions, so if so, then I'll catch you later. But under responsible use, I'm wondering if there are some occasions or some persons for whom there is no such thing. I guess, you know, I've just some friends of mine who are alcoholic, for instance, or dual dependent, say that they really sense that they were addicted from the first time they tried a mood-altering substance. Is that possible? I mean, that we can talk in terms of, for some, the limit is before, is abstinence really,
sure,
before
responsible. Yeah, I think abstinence does have to be a legitimate option for some people. And I'm not against that. If some people believe very strongly that they don't want to touch mood-altering chemical, that's great. If we could all be like that, we wouldn't have these problems. But in a society that uses chemicals, when you go to parties, they're there. You watch TV and it's before you. Every hour there's something on. For a lot of people, it's very hard to go through life abstaining.
Are there ways of detecting who those folks might be who really try it once and are already caught up in the cycle? For whom the only responsible use is abstention, compared to most who can use responsibility?
Well, some people say you can look at family history. It might be an indicator. Other researchers talk about an X factor because they really don't know. And so they just say it's because of X factor, whatever that might be a gene. Or some people say it's the sugar tolerance. Some of us crave sugar, and it's the alcohol. It's the sugar content in alcohol that is what hooks us on it, keeps us coming back and back. But yeah, abstinence. We all start out that way, don't we? We're all abstainers. But at some point in time, we learn that a drink tastes good. A beer after a hard day of work, or wine before a nice meal, or champagne at a wedding, or you know, whatever the occasion, we learn that this is a friend. And if it's used wisely and not abused, for most people, over 50% of our population, they don't have trouble with chemicals. They use it responsibly in a legitimate, reasonable, beneficial way. But there are 10% with whom you know, abstinence is the only wise choice. Okay, any other comments at this point? Yes?
I also think about our Christian responsibility as an example to other people. Now, we don't know. Sometimes people look to certain people thinking, well, if they do it, it must be all right. And they may be just the ones that should not have a drink.
Mm-hmm. The research has been done, and the group of people that have the lowest incidence of alcoholism, anybody know?
17
and
Jews.
Yes, it is. Which? Jews. Where drinking is part of ritual. And children do drink in the home, but it's part of their total experience. It's not you're going to go out and drink and have a good time. Drinking is part of the ritual. And the largest incidence of children that or young people that get involved in chemicals come from homes where there's alcoholism or close behind homes where there's total abstinence, interestingly enough. And so it seems where there's drinking that's reasonable and it's part of the flow of the day and the rituals that develop in the family, where it, you know, the drink is consumed with that in mind, alcoholism doesn't seem to be as big a problem out of those situations. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen, of course, because it can't. But that's what people have found, and that's kind of an interesting.
You know, somehow I think though that there's more to it than there's a got to be an alcoholic personality sort of thing, because from my personal experience, you know, if you have problems and you say, gee, you know, if I have a drink, I'll feel better. I don't like that, because then you can't figure out your problem.
Sure.
But I mean, someone that becomes an alcoholic, you know, this is, they run away from it. But so it depends on you yourself, whether you want to face up to your problems or, you know, get away from them, I think. So I don't feel like, do you think that anyone could become an alcoholic? I mean, I always think to myself that I don't think I could become an alcoholic because I don't like it.
Then you wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the effect of alcohol.
My wife gets headaches after one sip of wine. And I don't have to worry about her.
Right.
No, some people feel very strongly that, you know, they don't want to mess with it. And no, they won't become alcoholics. I think we all have the potential, initially, to become alcoholics if we wanted to. People say there's addictive personalities that become addictive. You know, if it's not alcohol, it's some other, it's work, or it's eating food, or it's exercise, or they're just addictive people, and they replace one addiction with another. And alcohol's always there. It's easy to get addicted to it. And there may be some credence to that, but some people do have personality traits that make them very competitive and rigid and impulsive, and they're more prone. Mm-hmm. But I believe that, you know, we can all change and change for the better. So, you know, the personality theory does have some weight behind it, but I don't think it's the answer all the time for what causes it. Okay, so responsible use is another way, hopefully, to prevent. And just like the lady said, that if someone has a good self-image, she didn't say this, but I'm reading into it, a good self-image and is able to cope with things as they come along, has good coping skills, when problems do occur, they won't have to turn to mood-altering chemicals to deal with whatever life is dealing to them at that point in time. A fourth area for preventing chemical dependency would be the whole area of health promotion. Here we're talking about ways to deal with stress, again, fitness and nutrition, so that you can be at the top of your abilities. And by health, I'm talking not just physical health, but emotional health, spiritual health, mental health, and social health. That if you're actively trying to be the best person you can be, you're going to realize that using chemicals, becoming dependent on chemicals, is not going to help you. It's going to cause you to degenerate physically and socially and mentally and in all these different areas. The last area for prevention is policy. And here I'm thinking of, well, we all pay taxes, and some of our taxes are used to subsidize the tobacco industry. I thought it was kind of interesting last year when HEW Secretary Califano stopped smoking, and he had a big campaign to cut back on smoking in this country. Yeah, of course, he's no longer secretary, is he? And there are other agencies that we're getting lots of our tax money to promote this whole industry. So, you know, that's policy. That's a decision that some lawmakers have made, that a lot of our money should go to develop this particular industry because it provides jobs and money for that part of the country. But you have to realize that the tobacco industry causes us to become dependent and causes people to die from cancer. Policy in terms of your communities. Some communities, there are what are known as head shops developing, where you can go in and get all of the paraphernalia used to smoke marijuana and things like this. And some communities allow it, and because it's providing jobs and income for the community. Other communities have become very upset that this type of thing is available for their children to go and buy. It's promoting dependency on chemicals rather than preventing it, and they've gotten involved in their communities and closed up these places. So there are different levels, you know, that you can work to try to bring about policy that's going to promote health and prevent disease and problems rather than just letting some of these happen. Because what most of us tend to do is we wait until the problems occur, as I mentioned at the opening, and then we come along and fix them up. The solution may be, you know, right under our eyes. It could be that we're always looking for experts. You know, if we're sick, who do we run to? The doctor, right? If we aren't getting along with our spouse, who do we go see? Probably a counselor. If we're having some spiritual problems, we'll go talk to the pastor. In other words, we're always looking for experts to tell us what to do, to fix us up. And the experts may be ourselves. We may know. Just a quick story, and then I'll get to your question. In northern Wisconsin, there are a lot of lumberjacks and big trees like around this part of the country. And there's a story about a Swedish lumberman, Tiny Svensson was his name, big man. And he had the reputation as being the best lumberjack in all of northern Wisconsin. With his saw, he could cut down 20 trees a day. And one day, he had to go into town because his saw was getting old and dull, and he wanted to get it sharpened. He went into the hardware store and said, "I need my saw sharpened." And the clerk said, "Tiny, we got some new saws in. I think you'd really like to try out. I could sharpen it, but why don't you try out this new saw? If you can cut down 20 saws using, or 20 trees using your saw, you can cut down 25 using this new saw that I have in." Well, Tiny wasn't so sure because he liked this saw and he'd been doing, you know, cutting down trees for many years with it. So he hesitated and the clerk said, "Look, I'll let you take it for a week. And if you can't cut down 25 trees, bring it back and I'll sharpen your old saw free of charge and you can take it." So Tiny thought that was a good deal, so he took the new saw, and a week passed, and he came in carrying the saw, and you know, he looked really tired and disappointed, and the clerk said, "Well, what's wrong, Tiny?" He said, I worked, and the most I could cut down were 12 trees a day. I want my old saw back." And the clerk said, "Well, there must be something peculiar here. Let me look at the saw." So he took it and flipped on the switch, pulled it, and you know, it started up. And Tiny said, "What was that?" And sometimes, did you get it? First time I heard it, I thought, "Oh, what's that all about?" I didn't catch it. And sometimes, you know, this whole thing about prevention has to start right with ourselves. And I think the bottom line issue here may be a spiritual issue, and that's why, you know, I want to move into that. Because I believe that, you know, someone that has a sense of meaning to his life has a belief or faith is not going to become dependent on chemicals to bring meaning and relationships into his life. But before I get into that, you had a question or comment?
Well, you were talking about yourself. Well, I was going to say, like, looking for the source. The source. Like Star Wars, but realizing that you are the source and I heard a definition of responsibility, and responsibility doesn't mean praise or taking the blame or whatever, but that you're the source of everything in your life. You're the source of your health. You're the source of whatever happens.
Yeah, the solution is sitting right here. Okay, it's not out there with a lot of experts. And until we believe that we are the solution, the problem's going to keep growing.
Well,
and that's what's happening.
Well, the thing about this, you know, being the source is that you have to take responsibility.
Sure. Yeah.
You can't usurp it to someone. Mm-hmm.
It's relatively easy to go to the doctor, especially at the end of the winter with feelings of depression and so forth, and they'll prescribe something for you. But the doctor that I had experience with very wisely said, you will have to know, you know, how you're doing.
Sure.
And he said that over and over again each time, you know, I would come back to talk to him. And I began to feel then that I was more in touch with how I was feeling, and it helped to solve a lot of the problem for me, you know, that maybe I didn't really need that.
Yeah.
A little extra, it wasn't much, but yeah. Still, a person could have gone the other way and just kept, you know, could have kept renewing the prescription and gotten as much as you wanted, I suppose, for a long while to come.
Yeah, that's true.
And if it got worse, they would give you more. I mean, that's the way it worked.
Mm-hmm.
But again and again, they wisely say, you are the person that's going to have to know how you feel. Now, could it have been, you know, had I been in a situation where I wasn't feeling better about myself, I suppose that's where a Christian community needs to be aware that some people don't seem to be what they were before. Like the friends noticed last night, the alcoholic just wasn't quite what they had known him to be in the past.
Yeah, I think the church as a caring community has a tremendous opportunity and challenge to prevent negative dependencies, one of which is chemical.
At the same time, there is a strange feeling of guilt or shame or something that keeps you from revealing to other people, unless they're very close friends of yours, that you are having a problem and it is necessary for you to take a drug or whatever it is that you need at that time. And I wish that we could overcome that too, so that people would feel free to talk about it. The thing that scared me was that, you know, if some people found out that I were taking a drug, whatever it might be, that every action of yours forever after would be interpreted, well, we understand that because she's a little, you know, off balance of living at the moment.
Or else, what is said, and I think this is very poor theology, but it is said, if you are a, quote, Christian, then you don't have these kinds
of
problems.
Yeah, that's another. The doctor said if you live in the fishbowl, you're expected to look like the fish, was the way he stated it, and that's a tough role sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet, it's been my experience, I guess, now working in chemical dependency, that I've been amazed at how many families have some, either an immediate family or a relative, that has had problems with a chemical of one sort or another.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like everybody's been touched by it. And once we start becoming vulnerable and risking and sharing some of this,
yeah,
we can kind of all link up and realize that we all have these problems. And we can all help each other. And that's why I think the church, as a caring community, is a place where we should be able to risk being human and sharing our brokenness and our problems, and then hearing the words of renewal and supporting one another.
I was wondering, what would it be like as far as talking with your spouse, you know, about something like, well, what would you expect, you know, if I saw this happening to you? Or at what stage would you want me to interrupt it, or how? Just like someone said, you should talk about how you want to split up your estate, you know, in case you get a divorce, because it's so hard once you're in the middle of a divorce.
Pre-planning.
Yeah, pre-planning.
Well, yeah, we didn't mention this, but I suppose under skill building, one of the key ways to prevent problems from occurring is good communication. That, you know, you have to keep that going. I think with parents and children, or between husband and wife, often when that starts breaking down, the relationship is getting wobbly, and that's because the relationship with the mood-altering chemical is getting stronger. And, you know, if that's not confronted and dealt with in an open, honest, caring way, then there will be more problems down the road.
It's been my experience with the last people I want to share any kind of thing like a chemical dependency is with my church community. I feel very hedged. it's sort of the righteousness, and that's my experience. I mean, I just read something in the last Lutheran thing that really hit me about Luther said, it's not your sin so much, but your righteousness that'll get you in trouble.
That's a good comment.
Yeah, I just was, especially last night, when you were intervening in a family to help Pat. I know a family of five, four are alcoholics. They've been intervened 5, 6, 7, 12 times. They've failed every time, and they don't even, just one speech, and I give up. You're right. And they go take the treatment again. Mm-hmm. What does the church do with the continual failure? A perennial failure? Or do we write those people off? Is the goodness of God gone? Can't, you know, is the image so defaced that we, I think that I like, yeah, that we are failures, all of us, and I would like the church community to be more of supporting, more of a non-judgmental, caring community.
Yeah, and we are the church, and you know, if that's how you feel, then you as part of the body of Christ show that to them. And just like the sinner on the cross, you know, he'd been a failure all his life, but at the last moment something happened, and you know, it might be the same with that family. That you try and try, and they fail and fail, and but maybe, you know, at some point the right person will say the right thing.
Yeah, turn them around. Always, never give up.
Because that's the message of the Bible, that God didn't give up on us, and He's given us a way out, in a sense. While the creation story says that we were created in the image of God, and we had we're a little less than the angels, and we were really super beings, we fell from that. The second doctrine of the fall. And we lost that intimate, close relationship. And so there's a gap between what we were created to be and what we actually are. And that's why we need the third doctrine of the church, which is what? How is the gap bridged? Yeah, that God has shown us how to bridge the gap. He sent His Son to die, and it's through our faith, our believing, that God's grace can reclaim us from our fallen state, our sinful state, our dependent state, however you want to define it. That's the source of our freedom. If we can accept that. If we can't accept it, then we'll continue to be tormented and insecure and searching after highs, like we talked about earlier in the week, in all sorts of man-made ways, and doomed to failure all the time, because that's not the way to get peace. It's only by believing this very simple act that occurred.
And occurs,
yes, exactly.
It seems to me we have an enormous need for education along the lines of what you're doing here within our community and our parishes and whatever to you know, to help people understand what it is that's happening in your life or somebody else's life that gets them into that pickle that's at the bottom of the slide there.
Yeah.
And to be able to intervene in those kind of instances before it gets too bad. I mean, I've been around to relatively a lot of educational type things, but I think about the people who haven't been given this kind of background to help them deal, it's pretty tough. We ought to go home and promote something. I don't know.
Take his tapes home with us.
Yeah, classes. Spread them around.
I saw an editorial. I want to read just a bit of it. It says, want to become rich. Maybe that's why I saw it. And I started reading it. Well, want to become rich, minimize dependencies. And I thought it was a way to get rich quick. So anyway, let me just read part of it. There are two ways to become rich. We can acquire plenty of money, or we can minimize our dependencies. The latter is the more effective and permanent way, minimizing dependency. We cherish independence. We want maximum freedom in order to make choices, in order to mature as people. We resist dependencies. We're convinced that unnecessary dependencies restrict our freedom, fence us in, deprive us of opportunities to grow. Self-imposed dependencies easily become straitjackets that diminish our options. Yet, ironically and tragically, we tend to cultivate unnecessary dependencies. We are easily inclined to restrict the very freedoms we need to make personal choices. Little by little, we fence ourselves into forms of slavery. We build that raw wall around us. Here's a list of some dependencies that we often excessively indulge in, and he lists a bunch, and you could do the same. Drugs, use only when necessary. Liquor, elbow bending is not the best exercise. Nicotine, it damages you and others. Food, only a glutton loves a constant snacker. Caffeine, coffee drinking has become a national religion. Power, an inclination to dominate people requires some restraints. Television, it stultifies more than instructs or inspires. Sports, the competition is as bad as the professionalism. Work, it's probably time to begin your second career. Money, and then he lists a few more. So these are all dependencies that we all have to some degree or another. Then he says, if you remove or restrict your unnecessary dependence, what's left? If you get rid of a lot of these things, what's left? The answer, you are. In your enlarged and enjoyed independence, you will be more yourself, more the noble and beautiful person you know you are. Before Jesus began his ministry, what did he have to do? Remember what occurred before he began his ministry? He went off into the wilderness, and what happened out there?
The devil tempted him.
The devil tempted him, and you know what the devil tempted him with? Jesus, led up by the Spirit, was tempted. There were three things the devil tempted him with. Same things we're tempted with. Material riches, prestige, and power. Same three issues that we want, I think. Only when Jesus rejected these three temptations, material riches, possessions, prestige, and power, was he able to begin his ministry. And the Bible says, then the devil left him. Okay? He was set free. Once he'd rejected these dependencies, he was set free to begin his ministry. And if you read the Gospels with this in mind, Jesus' ministry was really setting people free from their dependencies. He saved them, salvation, saved their spiritual selves, and he also healed them. And he didn't make a distinction between healing the physical hurts and saving the spiritual needs, and in fact, calling them to repentance, the mental. He was concerned with the whole person, whether they be spiritually in need or physically in need. He healed them, and his ministry is a ministry of healing, and making whole what was broken, making straight what was crooked, freeing those that are dependent. What should I do to inherit the kingdom? The rich young ruler said, you're dependent on your treasures, get rid of them. They're just most of the stories, the healing stories, this is what he's doing. He's setting people free from their dependencies. In Luke, do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust consume, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And I think if your heart and your belief and your treasure is turned towards God, there's no room for abusing chemicals. I really believe that. Prevention may start with a strong faith and spiritual belief, and the church can really play a powerful role in preventing chemical dependency or any of the other dependencies we talk about. One other passage in John, just a real short one. So Jesus said to the Jews who believed in him, "If you obey my teaching, you are really my disciples. You know the truth, and the truth will make you free." And what is the truth? What's the truth he's talking about? What is the truth that makes us free?
In that context, it was their relationship with God as gift. The grace that comes with Christ.
Okay, yeah. That he came to bridge the gap between our hurts, our brokenness, and becoming children and sons of God in the garden where we started out. That is the way to be set free, to simply believe that. Another way to illustrate this is that we all in life have jobs, and we have relationships with people, and we have hobbies and marriage. And often we try to define who we are, to try to make sense and some meaning from what we're doing. And we try to understand who we are, why we're here, try to make some meaning into us. But if we try to define ourselves from what we do, we're sort of insecure and incomplete and disconnected, and there isn't really any true understanding. We don't know the truth. If we're trying to find the answers in what we do out here, we're bound to be insecure and frustrated, and because we're dependent on what we can do. So our being is incomplete. Now, if we start with being, if we can come to an understanding of what we believe, this is what I believe. This is the source of my security. This is where I find my peace. Our belief then can influence what we value. It influences our attitudes. It shapes our hopes and our visions. And we set goals and make plans to reach this. And in a sense, everything lines up. Whereas up here, nothing seems to make sense. It's just kind of scattered. We haven't really defined our beliefs or our values or attitudes. We're too busy out here trying to make, do things. Here, we start with our being, who we are as children of God. This defines then what we do. And as we go out into the world, this is our motivation. And when we can kind of line up like this, I went to Yale Divinity School, and I'll let you in on a secret. When we line up like this, it's called bingo. We're self-integrated. Things make sense. And so, until you really grapple with this whole what you believe in, until you can come to some assurance that God has come to bridge the gap between our harmful dependencies and wants us to be his children and you know, all we have to do is accept the gift that Jesus came and died for all this. If we can believe that, it shapes our whole life. We don't have to be dependent on chemicals, on any man-made things to find peace and truth. And then we can go out into the world assured that we are our only dependence, really, where our treasure is with God. And that's a tremendous load off our shoulders. A lot of us like to put ourselves above Yahweh and above God. And we're always saying, yeah, but. Just wait a little bit, God. Yeah, but I'm not ready yet. And it's kind of a lonely place to be up there above God. And the person that's out there doing all these things to show how good he is and how worthy he is will never be free. He'll always feel insecure and incomplete. But the person that can see that, you know, God's grace flows into his life, and this is the source of what he believes to be important, he is free. Because thieves can't break in, and moths and rust can't consume. You know, the treasure, the focus is going in the right direction. And I think this is how to prevent chemical dependency. And the treatment centers know that, because when someone comes in with chemical dependency, they don't tell him about all the pharmacological terms and all the medical things that are happening and what it's doing to his liver and what it's doing to his relationships with his wife and kids and job, do they? What do they start with? They say, you have to admit that you're powerless and that you need help from a higher being. That's the first step in AA, the first step in treatment. Because they know that's the only way that this person can be helped. And it's the same for us.
This is very true of a cousin of mine. Took the cure for alcoholism, and he had to retake it because he couldn't do it by himself. And he said, there were two things I did wrong. I didn't start going to my church. And also, I didn't join Alcoholic Anonymous. Mm-hmm.
Trying to do it by himself.
Yeah, he said, you'll see me in the church next Sunday. Very true. That was two things he emphasized, that he had to do before he could help himself.
So if we're going to be dependent on any one thing, what should we be dependent on? Because then we're free. That's the message. That's the truth. And the truth will make us free.
Would there be any reason, we had some experience with a couple of, one was the alcoholism and the other was both alcohol and drugs combined, these were adults, where they would not involve the family or even give the family information on how the patient was doing in their treatment? What would be the reason for that?
Backward treatment facility.
We just couldn't, you know, in a major medical center.
Yeah. No, it's alcoholism now is viewed as a family disease, and everybody's affected. And for the recovering alcoholic to maintain sobriety after treatment, the whole family has to be involved. And there aren't too many facilities that still leave the family out. The family is very important to recovery. So. Well, there are 5 minutes left, open for comments or observations on prevention or anything that I've talked about or you want to talk about.
Yes. I know of only one church, unfortunately, that as the entire congregation of 900 families really put that into a practical every family situation, the hope, vision, and goal. Thanksgiving is a really great day where you can judge a church if we're going to stoop down the gutter and be judgmental. There is no Thanksgiving Day dinner because the Bible plainly points out to you that dinner is not the thing. You help the widows in your area, right? And her children, and the men and women in prison. I challenge you, how many here went to prison and really made a testimony of love? Okay. This place is so dynamic, they have their own airplane, 24 hour a day standby pilot, not a student, thank you, or they're really gone.
So they
if you've got a problem, boy, that church will go.
They
right.
sort of come from here, and this defines what
right.
they want to do in the world.
And I'm ashamed to tell you that where I come from, when I get back, I know what's going to be on the agenda. Pave the parking lot. That's how far down the gutter we come from.
Well, we're human, you know, and that's the point, that we all fail every day. As a people, as a society, as a family, as a country, as a world. And that's why prevention is such a difficult topic to speak on, because the solution is a difficult message. If you're going to accept that and believe that and then go out and do it, it's very hard to do.
But by the same token, mm-hmm. Pat.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but I was supposed to say that was a role play yesterday, and I don't even know your real name.
That's
I
fine.
Called you Pat.
Pat, right now. Finish. 4 minutes on. You know, let's go.
I think expectations have a lot to do with it too. Lord, somehow never put the screws on anybody.
But me and my ego, you see, and this power and the prestige thing, paving the parking lot, for crying out loud. How can you even justify it? That's what it's doing. No way.
Does it need paving?
No, it don't need paving. Nobody's parking lot needs paving. You've had children steal food out of your mess kit, like some of us have, right? You think about the energy thing, I'll tell you. And I'm in the commercial world now, heating and air conditioning, so throw that back at me. I got conflicts of interest too. You're not sitting there alone, fella.
Yeah.
We're all in the same.
Yep, we're all in the same boat. But some will admit it out loud and some of us won't. It doesn't make us any better if we're vocal. But, you know, we got to do something.
Yeah, that's why we simply have to admit eventually that we can't do it on our own.
No, sir.
And that's hard because we fight against it. I fought against it, and I bet you everybody in here struggled with it too.
And me, so myself,
just,
and I.
Admit that and accept it, and then feel the release that you don't have to, you know, do it all by yourself. That is a tremendous release when you can finally admit that. And it's something you have to do almost every day, and that's why a recovering alcoholic says day by day, take one day at a time and try to stay sober and do what's proper this day, and tomorrow's a new day, and do it again.
Part of that is having the courage to tell someone, you know, that you've had this problem or whatever it is, and then to, you know, you've held back all this time and you finally tell someone, and this friend or whoever just says, why didn't you tell me before? And you realize at that point that you could trust, and there was no judgment on their part of you, that they loved you a lot, to say that to you.
It's kind of ironic. I don't know how many of you know recovering alcoholics. Among the most spiritually sensitive people, I think, around, and yet many of them maybe don't go back to the organized church because they don't feel accepted. And yet, tremendous sense of their dependence on God and the importance of their
what
spiritual
life. What it
means
life. To be forgiven.
Yeah. Yeah. And often we good church people have just shut them out because they're alcoholics. And how tragic that is. I think we can learn from them much more than they can learn from us.